Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is wonderful to see you all here today. My name is Marshall McKnight, and on behalf of Nassau Presbyterian Church and the Adult Education Committee, welcome to the beginning of the end of the main line. The surprising past and uncertain future of an American Protestant powerhouse. I should probably point out, and in the title, there's a question mark behind the main line. Just wanted to point that out. This is our focus of our fall small group series that began this past week with people meeting, both virtually and in person. And it is another LinkedIn learning session as Dave Davis preaches on this same topic during worship and connects it with Bible stories from Acts and the Old Testament. This theme will continue for the next 5 weeks with today's speaker, Heath Carter. Dr. Carter last joined us in adult ed when he made a virtual presentation over 4 weeks during the pandemic, and that was on the challenges faced by the American church in the 18th and 19th centuries. It is such a pleasure to welcome him today in person, and an honor to introduce him, which I will do in a moment. But first, let's pray. Please pray with me. Gracious God, thank you for this day and this time together. We are so grateful for the multitude of heavenly host that surrounds us. We are grateful for those saints who served you long before us. Please open our hearts and minds today so that we may understand you better and know how we may better serve you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
I first met Heath in person on a beautiful weekday afternoon. I took a break from working remotely and took a walk, and I walked right by his house, and he was sitting on his porch working on his latest book about William Jennings Bryan. And I was so impressed with his last adult ed talks that I nearly asked him for his autograph.
Uh-oh.
And when the book comes out, I probably will do that. When is that book coming out?
Good question. Hopefully in about 2 years.
In about two years.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's the hope.
Set your calendars. Mm. Dr. Carter is Associate Professor of American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary, where he teaches and writes about the intersection of Christianity and American public life. He earned his BA in English and Theology from Georgetown University, an MA from University of Chicago Divinity School, and PhD in History from the University of Notre Dame. He also taught at Valparaiso University and was a visiting fellow at Vanderbilt University. He and his talented family are active members of our Nassau Church. Today, Heath will guide us on a survey of America's changing religious landscape. Please give a warm welcome to Heath Carter.
Good morning. Wonderful to be with you all. I'm thrilled to be able to spend 5 weeks together thinking about a topic that I think, for reasons we'll get into today, couldn't be more timely. Kind of the question of the past and the present of the Protestant mainline and its engagement in public life in the United States. I want to talk a little bit today, kind of set the framework or the context for a series that's going to include a significant engagement also with history, which is my field. And sometimes when you tell people you're a historian, you usually get one of two reactions. Some people say, "Oh, I'm a huge history buff," and they tell you the latest book they've read. And the other reaction is people say, "Oh, I really had a bad experience in history in high school. Really hated my high school history teacher, and so I just never pursued it." I teach history over at Princeton Seminary, and one of my convictions and one of the things I'm always trying to convince our students of is that history matters whether you're a history buff or not. And it really matters for believers. It matters for people who care about the church. We need to know how we got here if we want to know how to move faithfully forward. The other thing that's true is that you're already a historian. We're all already historians. We all have ideas about the past in the back of our minds that shape the way we think about the present. We all have stories about how we as persons, we as families, as communities, as a nation, how we got here, that impact the way we think about where we should go. One of the gifts of history as a field is that it can help us to really take a closer look at our own internal narratives and to scrutinize them in light of the evidence that we have and the things that we can really figure out and know, and to kind of, sometimes history and memory line up well and sometimes they don't. And sometimes when they don't, it's really interesting and an invitation to kind of explore deeper waters. The other thing I just want to say, I guess, up front by way of context, another gift of history in difficult times and in difficult conversations, and this is being tested right now, I think, but nevertheless, one of my deep convictions is that a gift of my field is that it can offer a shared footing in tough conversations. Sometimes when we look to the past, it's a way to come at contemporary challenges in a way that hopefully can bring maybe not everybody along, but a lot of folks along and create a conversation where even in the midst of deep disagreement, we might be able to find ways to hang together. So I hope we can do that. I guess I have a question for you up front, which is, you know, this word in my title, the mainline, it's a word that, you know, comes up a lot in my field. But I wonder what it means to you. What is the mainline? I think these days a lot of us here, we hear more about evangelicalism. And there's been a lot of press about evangelicalism in the last 20 years, in part just due to national politics and the role of evangelicals in the national political scene. What is the mainline? Anyone want to? We don't have to pass the mic, right? I'll just repeat back what I hear. Anyone want to take a? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting. Yeah. Yeah, so she says, I think about denominations, whereas evangelicals can tend to be non-denominational. But she also says, and this is a really important point, that sometimes, you know, there may be evangelicals also within mainline denominations. Any other initial thoughts on what is the mainline? What does that word mean to you? Yeah. 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 So he says sort of the ethos of an earlier moment in American life, in American history, Eisenhower and that kind of era. And I think that's another important piece, right? This idea of a certain kind of Protestant tradition that's been deeply linked historically to kind of the consciousness, the ethos, the spirit of the nation as a whole. The mainline has played a hugely important role in American public life. Yeah. 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 Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. What I hear partly there is that the mainline is a tradition that cares about tradition in some sense. That there's an orientation toward a connection to a longer past, a longer history. I don't want to totally resolve this right now. I wanted to kind of just tee this up because I think part of what, you know, part of how we sometimes use the term mainline today is a little bit, sits uneasily a little bit alongside the history. And so I want to kind of leave open a little bit what we mean by it, partly because the meaning has changed over time. So next week, I want to look at a critical moment in the history of this tradition and think a little bit about how it might change the way we think about what it is and what counts as it. So we'll keep that question on the table, but I want to zoom way out here at the outset. And what I'd like you to do is actually take about a minute or two and talk to your neighbor about this chart. This is a chart that shows rates of religious adherence in the United States from the founding of the nation until about two decades ago. And effectively what's meant by religious adherence here is membership, church membership. So this is the percentage of Americans who belong to a church over the course of the centuries. This is 1776. Can you all see this well enough in the back? 17% in 1776 up to 2,062%. Talk to your neighbor for 1 minute. I want to know what strikes you here and or what's surprising here. What do you make of this chart's telling a story? I want to talk about the story it tells, but talk to your neighbor about what you notice here. It's mainly tracking Christianity here. It's mainly tracking Christianity. It's from a book about the churching of America. Yeah. Yeah. These are great questions. Women are being tracked here. Women are also being tracked in this chart. It's a great question. Yeah. Yes. Yep. You would have some African American folks tracked earlier, but you're right to catch. I mean, you all are. This is a good class. Look at this. You all asking clarification questions. It's so good. Okay. Talk to your neighbor for a minute. What do you notice here? Take another 30 seconds. Another 30 seconds. Yep. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
We have good records.
They're not perfect, but we have. You have to do guesswork. I mean, you basically have, like, you know the number of congregations, and you can kind of figure out the average size of congregations, and so that's the way people figure it out. Yeah. All right. Let's come back together. Let's come on back together here. We could talk about this chart this entire hour. We don't have time to do that. There's a lot to say about it. What are some of the things that came up as you were chatting? Yeah. It costs money to join a church. This is a complicated issue and story, but there's no question that in much of the 19th century, you had to pay for pews, right? And so that is it's an excellent point. What else? What else came up as you were chatting? Yeah.
It's not going down.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more striking points here, right? We're going to pick up at 2000 in just a second. Yeah.
Well, we were just reflecting. It seems counterintuitive, but maybe it's because the mainline decline has been such a dominant narrative. So everyone's like, so you would think, oh, it's all going down. But there's so many other churches that are growing and expanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what that's demonstrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
The x-axis, the dates are the years. They're jumping around. Right?
So yeah. Yeah, it's not an even. I mean, partly what this chart is trying to do is use the data that we have about church membership over time, and we don't have data, you know, consistently across these hundreds of years. So it's picking years where we have better data. Anything else? Yes.
I thought maybe in the early years people were more
Yeah.
And they weren't in settlements.
Yeah.
And a lot of people weren't in settlements or places where they wasn't.
Yeah, people more spread out and yeah, less likely maybe to get to a church. That's certainly an issue in the earlier colonial period. Yeah, itinerant ministers, fewer churches in the earlier colonial period. Anything else? Yeah.
The revival. I've got my dates wrong. What's the name of the man from England?
George Whitfield. Yeah, I mean, he's coming around this era. Yeah, I mean, this is a big jump here. I don't know if you can see. This is 1776. This is 1850. So this is a long period and a big jump. But the revivals are huge. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. Anything else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's one kind of measure of Christian engagement over the course of U.S. history. I mean, one of the things I think is interesting about this chart, it does, I certainly grew up, I think, with a sense that Christianity had some past glory moment in the colonial period when everybody was Christian and it was this, right? And this chart offers some good, solid grounds for thinking critically about that narrative, right? I mean, part of it tells a story. If we had more time, we could go into a lot of depth. I'll just kind of fly here. I mean, you know, part of what we know is that outside of New England, not a lot of enthusiasm in terms of Christian institutions in the colonial period. But you know, starting around the founding of the nation, and then accelerating, you know, quickly in the early 19th century. You have these great awakenings, and a nation, you know, that you know had emerged as with deep questions. Actually, what's the future of Christianity in this new nation that's disestablished the church at a federal level, and by within a generation of its founding, the states had also disestablished Christianity. What's the future of Christianity going to be? It was sort of uncertain. The revivals, an upswelling of kind of conversion and engagement in church life. John Butler, a historian in my field, famously wrote a book, Awash in a Sea of Faith, about this generation after the Revolution where Americans are flocking to churches in both fields and boom towns all over the nation. Revival is kind of sweeping the land. And then you have a little bit of a plateau, a little bit of a dip down after the Civil War, which was such a trauma, right? And as Mark Knoll has written, it was a theological crisis in addition to a political one. In the wake of Reconstruction, you have the emergence of more independent black churches and flourishing black institutional life, an upswelling that kind of continues steadily up through the 20th century into the era of the post-World War II revival. Which a lot of times, sir, you were saying this a moment ago, when we think about the mainline and the kind of apex of the Protestant mainline, we associate it with this moment after the Second World War, where in truth, you know, we reached a kind of historic apex of American Christian engagement in church institutions. One of the things that's true, and that also came up in the initial clarification question moment here, is across the board, across this entire period, one of the things that's true is that women are always in the majority of this chart, of the folks who belong to churches in almost every denomination across time in the United States. Women have always outnumbered men in the pews. Very famous article arguing that American religious history is women's history, in part because women have truly even for, you know, centuries when they were not admitted to kind of formal positions of leadership, they've been running churches in many ways for a really long time. So if that's a sense of kind of the longer sweep, that in some sense over the course of the history of the United States, you have a rising engagement in Christian institutions, part of what you know, where we pick up today in 2022 is a very different moment. In a very different moment in time, I think this is a timely series in part because the charts are changing quite rapidly in just the last decade, actually. And so I want to spend time today, the next few weeks we're going to go back in time, but today I want to really situate us firmly, ground us in the present moment as we think about what are the stakes of this history? What can we learn from it? I want to think about where we are situated. And I think it won't come as any surprise to any of you that in many ways we're living through a time of great challenge for both American democracy and American Christianity alike. And these stories are also, of course, intertwined. We're living through an era marked by alarming levels of polarization, political polarization, marked sometimes by moments of violent confrontation that we've seen playing out on television in recent years across the country. I think it's good, as a historian, I want to always say to say that, you know, contemporary levels of division in our society are not unprecedented. They're not unprecedented. We fought a civil war in the United States, and things in by many measures have been worse at moments in the past. So we shouldn't, I mean, you know, that can give us some assurance, I think, as we approach our contemporary moment. But we also know that today, oh, this is this thing that I just want to point out about, you know, women. This is the gap is narrowed in recent years, but I couldn't find a good chart. We need someone to make a good chart on this fact. But lots of evidence showing women have been in the majority all the way through. Even though we can take some assurance from the knowledge that this isn't an unprecedented moment, it's troubling to know that young people today, 50% of young people today, think that American democracy is either in trouble or failed. And more than a third of young people today believe there could be another civil war in their lifetime. Part of what has happened in recent years, let me see if I've got my button working, is the emergence of deep mistrust on the ground between people who disagree about politics, about culture, about social questions. Part of what has happened in recent years, and these are ancient charts, they're from 2014, but these numbers have actually, aren't great new charts for 2022, but I have the numbers, and they've more than doubled. Basically that in recent years, Americans of both major political parties have come to see at alarming rates, I think, folks in the other party as not just wrong about key issues, but as a threat to the nation. As a threat to the nation. Today, 60% of Democrats regard the Republican Party as a serious threat to the U.S. 70% of Republicans regard the Democratic Party as a serious threat to the United States. And so it's not surprising that along the way, over the last generation, plummeting trust in government, in the main institutions that democratic life runs through. In the late 1960s, more than three quarters of Americans had some kind of basic trust in their government in Washington, whereas in 2022, that number sits down near about 20%. We could talk for 5 weeks about the deeper sources of all this. Part of what we know is that this mistrust, this polarization, isn't just a secular political phenomenon, but it really runs right through the heart of American Christianity. And part of what we know, so Robert Wuthnow, who's a sociologist over at the university, wrote 35 years ago a book called The Restructuring of American Religion. And the argument of that book 35 years ago was that the main line, American Christianity, was being restructured, whereas denominational identity, Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, Episcopalian, etc., had long been so core to people's sense of themselves and what they were up to in the world, that increasingly American Christians were being realigned down political lines. That whereas in the past, a Methodist or Baptist or whatnot would have had a sense of, you know, an identity as a Methodist or as a Presbyterian that sets me apart from Methodists, that increasingly what Wuthnow noticed, again, starting already 35 years ago, was that conservative Methodists were starting to feel like they had more in common with conservative Presbyterians and conservative Baptists and conservative Catholics, even, than they did with progressives in their own denomination. And that part of what, you know, I mean, we know, in fact, you know, 35 years later, that Wuthnow's book was incredibly prescient. Historic divides between evangelicals and Catholics have melted away in many sense. You know, those were such remarkable historic divides going back all the way to the era of the Reformation that in the last generation have significantly faded as sort of Christianity itself has been realigned down sort of political lines. And in the midst of that, so again, thinking about kind of the framework, the moment that we're in today, if democracy is in a time of great challenge, so is Christianity in this country. So, you know, there's lots and lots of different ways you can imagine all the different ways we can measure kind of the health or whatnot of Christianity in the United States today. Just in the last 15 years, the percentage of Americans who say that they pray daily has dropped substantially. This is also true for the percentage of Americans who would say that religion is very important in their lives. You can see that in recent years, declines in Christian adherence and belonging have really been concentrated on the Protestant end of the spectrum. And it wasn't that long ago that people were saying that the main line, these declines were really concentrated in the main line. And there was a kind of, in my view, deeply flawed line of argumentation that said, well, the main line's liberal and liberal theology isn't popular. And so it's no question, you know, as the main line's moved left and from this kind of polemical point of view, moved away from you know, Christianity itself in some sense, that people have lost interest in it. That argument, which I think was always wrong, has been harder and harder to make as evangelical churches in recent years have also really slowed in growth and sometimes started to experience decline themselves, including the Southern Baptist Church, you know, the kind of largest Protestant denomination in the United States, which has seen slowing baptism rates, declining membership numbers. It's true across Protestant denominations on the left and on the right. It's true of the ELCA and the LCMS and the Lutheran world. It's true across the board that Protestant adherence, Protestant kind of belonging, and we'll talk more about what exactly it is that's going on. But part of what we know and part of what you've probably heard some about is the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S, N-O-N-E-S. The nuns have come onto the scene in a remarkable way in the last 20 or so years. And when we initially learned about the nuns, how many of you have heard of the nuns? N-O-N-E-S. Yeah, a bunch of you. I mean, this is a very complicated group of Americans who are it's not possible to generalize entirely across them. The thing that they have in common is that they don't identify or affiliate with a denomination. They don't express their commitment. So many of the nuns are, they may be spiritual. They may be Christian. They may say that they believe in the creeds. They may say that they love Jesus and are helped in their life by the Holy Spirit. But they're not interested in saying I'm Methodist or I'm Presbyterian or I, you know, in many cases, some nuns go to church but don't identify with the church that they go to. Many nuns don't go to church. They've lost interest in kind of institutional forms of Christianity. I mean, the thing that's really striking, so this is a very short timeline here, 2007 to 2021. In 2007, 78% of Americans identified and affiliated with Christian denomination. You can see in the course of 15 years, that number has dropped 14%. That's a remarkable decline in such a short period of time. Part of what we know, and I don't know how well you can see this chart in the back, but I think it's really interesting and important, is that there's a kind of generational aspect to the nuns, and they skew young. So when we think about the future of the mainline, when we think about the future of Christianity in the United States, we can't help but look at this chart, which if you can't, can you see this? Can you discern? So this is looking at the percentage, the share of each generation who are nuns. And you can see at the bottom here, the greatest generation, the silent generation, are the least likely to be nuns. They're the most likely to be still affiliating, expressing a kind of identity, denominational identity or whatnot. But as you move younger through the generation, we don't have Gen Z on here, unfortunately, but you can see, you know, boomers slightly more likely, just over 15%. Gen X trending significantly up above 20%. And millennials moving kind of off the chart here. Over, you know, 30% of millennials who identify as nuns. Yes?
Can you clarify, are you speaking as nuns speaking specifically toward Christianity and denomination? So let's say a devout Muslim or a devout Jew or a devout...
These are people who affiliate with no religious organization of any kind. So, I mean, if they're...
Like across the board.
Across the board. It's not just Christianity. It's across the board. These are people who have, in some sense, disaffiliated from institutional forms of religion. Yeah, you know, not exclusively Christian. We don't, you know. So, like I said, we don't know entirely what's going on here. I mean, we're in the midst of this moment, and it's hard to say, you know. Where will we be 10 or 15 or 20 or 40 years from now? It's unclear. As people get older, as these millennials age, will they, you know, become more interested? When, you know, as they have children or whatnot, will they become more interested again in institutional forms of religious life, or will they not? There are lots of kind of big open questions about where things are headed. But what we know, one analyst of this data recently noted, the younger you are, the less likely you are to believe in God, the less likely you are to describe yourself as spiritual or regularly pray. Americans 18 to 29, only 21% report going to church weekly, 27% say they pray daily. There's a lot of uncertainty in this moment. Yeah.
Where do the nuns get their values?
Yeah. It's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really complicated question. I mean, where do the nuns get their values? A lot of these are folks that grew up in church, and so maybe they have their values from church. I mean, I don't know if there's one answer to that question. You know, the thing that is interesting, and so part of what I'm interested in thinking about together here is this chart. Again, with charts, you always be careful with charts. I'm a historian. We don't do a lot of charts, but I felt like it was important to do some charts today. You know, this tells a certain kind of story, and the story really is about institutional, different ways, I think, that the generations engage with institutions. That's a big part of what this data can tell us. And we know it not just religiously, but really across the board, that younger folks are less likely to believe in institutions, less likely to have faith that institutions, and I don't mean just religious institutions, I mean political institutions, cultural institutions. I mean, you look at, you know, if we were to go back to that first chart, right, where you saw the kind of post-war revival moment, where you have maximal engagement at some level with religious institutions. That's also a moment where you have a lot of engagement in the Rotary and a lot of engagement in all kinds of other civic, social, political organization. In some ways, many folks' lives ran through membership. And they ran through kinds of organizations. And this is an important way that you were plugged into community. It was an important way that you lived your life.
Yeah. First of all,
where we would see the rise of things that you can do on Sunday morning that aren't church. And this chart, cross. And then the other part of it is, I think this chart does us a disservice by separating things into generations.
Mm.
If we look, we see that after 1988, there's a rise in nuns in every generation. And so I think we need to think cross-generationally that, you know, the greatest generation is influencing the silent generation, which is influencing the boomers, the Gen X, and the millennials. So those increases in nuns in those generations grow in the next generation. They influence the next generation. As much as we would wish our Christianity would grow our next generation, that's happening here as well.
Yeah, there's no question that this is not exclusively a young person's phenomenon. And so it is helpful to think, I think, across the generations about the moment that we're in that's affecting people across generational lines. Yes?
I have two questions.
Yep.
And also, I think it's tribalism too, unfortunately, because, and I'm curious if you probably will get into this, the research that you've done on, the black church versus the white church, and Dr. Martin Luther King said that basically church hours was the most sacred hour in the United States. It still seems to be.
Yeah.
And they're trying to investigate churches.
Yeah.
And they find that the white churches are not welcome.
Yeah.
Which is so
un-Christian. Yeah.
But so I'm just curious how much of that is
Yeah, there, it's a great question about, I mean, is one source of the divestment from institutional Christianity concern about hypocrisy or kind of faltering faith in the kind of witness of the church. And there have been studies that show, I think, especially younger generations are deeply frustrated by the public witness of what they, you know, think of when they think about Christianity and public life. It does not appeal. And so that's one piece of a complicated, larger story that isn't only about that, but it is certainly a piece. I think there's been really interesting data to support that that is part of it. Yeah, sir.
Have you data on any school of millennials, but the incidence of the statistics of paganism?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Oh, paganism. I don't have good data on that. My sense is paganism as such is not like surging per se, that that part of what, again, we don't, there's lots of folks working on diving deeper into this data. And it's a mistake to think that there's a monocausal explanation, I think, or that there's one experience that's driving this kind of tendency toward disaffiliation. There really are a lot of things happening, and there are a lot of different experiences. Like I said, you could have a nun who's never been to church and has no interest in church. You could have a nun who grew up in church and who still is, I mean, I know lots of people that would fit this bill, right? Who grew up in church, who still are like, I believe in the creeds, I believe in Jesus, he's, you know, Jesus is my Lord and Savior, but I don't need to go to church. That's an experience. There's an experience, I mean, there's all sorts of, I mean, so within this umbrella term of nuns, there's just lots of different kinds of experiences that are a part of that larger thing. I mean, to know that there is at some level, I mean, the larger thing is important too, though, right? That at some level, Americans' ways of being engaged in civic life and in the life of, you know, in Christian community are really changing at a remarkably quick rate. Yes.
Way
Yeah. Yeah, it's another interesting idea. I think, the question is sort of like, did the internet drive some of this? That, you know, people can kind of plug in online to a community of like-minded folks rather than have to go in person to a community where you might have to engage with a lot of folks who are different, but that in which maybe you would also come to appreciate different sorts of folks. I think that's an interesting theory as well. Part of what we know is that even in-person kinds of communities are less and less likely to be places where different kinds of folks come together. Americans are just moving away from people that they have different views from. They are shopping. A lot of this research on polarization recently has argued, and I think convincingly, that in the not so distant past, you know, we all have many different kinds of identities that shape our lives. You know, we may be Christian. We may have a political party affiliation. We may have a sport that we like to play. We may be parents. Lots of different identities. And in the past, those identities were kind of cross-cutting. So yeah, you had a political party identity, but in church you might sit next to people who had a different political party identity. So you got to come to know them. Or you are on a soccer team, you know, and there you got to know people who were different. And so you could kind of sustain a complex view of people that you disagreed with. But part of what's happening as everything from where Americans live to where they shop to where they go to church is increasingly those other identities are being kind of eaten up by a mega political identity. And these other identities increasingly don't have the kind of traction on our lives. In large part because people are less and less likely to have a deep relationship with folks who are different than them and who view the world differently than them. It's just becoming less and less, obviously there's lots of people who still have that, but it's less and less common for folks to have that. And those relationships provide some kind of break on the tendency to just dismiss others. And so Christian churches where you'd have a wider mix are just less and less common these days. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'd need more charts to kind of capture the distinctive experiences of different ethnic and racial groups. This is capturing everybody. I mean, this data includes everyone, but it's not broken out by different ethnic and racial groups. And certainly there's vastly different experiences for, you know, brand new immigrants versus, you know, I mean, so this is just showing you kind of, it's breaking this data down and kind of by age and generation. I don't have the charts for breaking it down by ethnic and racial data. I think what we know is that kind of at a broader level, disaffiliation is proceeding apace. You can break it down in lots of different ways and find variations. And we can learn from kind of those sorts of variations. We're almost out of time, I think, right? Is it Marshall? We get till...
Yeah, a few more minutes.
Okay, a few more minutes. Let me kind of bring it back here for one second, and if we have time for another question, we can. I mean, part of what I think is interesting about this data, and part of what I find, there is a very intentional question mark, by the way, in the title of the series, the end of the mainline question mark. There has been, you know, to the extent that people outside of a place like Nassau Presbyterian have heard of the mainline in recent years, it's usually in newspaper articles about its decline. And lots of emphasis on decline. And there's obviously a lot to say about that. We've been looking at lots of charts that document different ways in which one might think about decline. But part of what is interesting and important and that I'd like to infuse our time together this next month with is also a spirit of curiosity and possibility and wonder about what might come next. Because part of what's really interesting to me and working at Princeton Seminary, worshiping here, is we're at a moment where we're no longer gonna be able to operate in autopilot mode as mainline Protestants. It's not gonna work. or to the extent that it works, it's even if we tried to do that, it's going to be a totally different experience than it was earlier in the lifetimes of some of the folks in this very, very room right now. The kinds of things that you could assume as a mainline Protestant in 1950 or 1960 can no longer be assumed. And so I think part of what's really interesting about the moment we're in is the sense that we don't know what's going to come. We don't know what's coming next, and we get to be a part of shaping what comes next. And I hope that as we here at Nassau think about what it might mean to shape the thing that's coming next, we can also learn from where we've been, learn from the folks who have gone before us. I want to be careful in this series, and I think you'll see as we move through it, I don't have myself this idea that, oh, the 1950s and 1960s, that was the glory day. That was the moment. That was it. And gosh, don't we just wish we could go back to that? I don't think so. And on so many different fronts, right? So I think in some sense, it's helpful to be reminded of that there's not a past glory age that we want to recreate now. That's not, I don't think that can be the goal. And in some sense, if we know, and it sounds like there's a wider understanding in the room that's not the way to think about the past, that we can come to this moment also with a sense not only of grief and lament about decline and whatnot, but also excitement about the possibilities of what might come out of the kind of, I don't know how we should characterize it. I mean, there's some rubble from that earlier era. And so what is going to come out of the rubble? Part of what I think we can do, and as we think about that question, and I want to come back to that the final week, is to think together about where do we want to go? Where do we hope to go here at Nassau, here, you know, as mainliners kind of more broadly? But before we kind of come back to that question, I want to go through history, and I want to think together about both the great achievements of the mainline past, but also the shortcomings of our past. And we can learn from both. I want to think together these next few weeks about the ways that the folks who went before us navigated moments of great turmoil and tumult, like the one that we're in right now. And I think we'll learn through revisiting their stories. Next week will partly be right here at Nassau Church in the 1920s. I want to think about what was happening here. When we think about their stories, I think we'll find in them lots of flaws, lots of things to lament, but also gifts for us as we move forward. So excited to think about with you the kind of connections between past and present, and how, if we have a sense of how we got here, what it might mean to move faithfully forward together. Do I have time for one more question? We're done.
Yeah, we have time for a couple questions.
Okay, a couple questions. Anyone that hasn't spoken that wants to jump in? Otherwise, I've got... Yeah, please.
So I just wanted to point out that despite our chuckling in the room and your sense that going back to the 50s isn't necessarily the way to grow the church, there's a huge segment of mm-hmm. Christians who think that is exactly yeah. what we need to do.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to
yeah.
point that out.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think one of the reasons why it's great to spend time with history is we can go back and I think get a clear-eyed view of the reasons why we don't want to go back, but also to see some of the ways that people were faithful in the past. And it can be complicated, and it is complicated. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if one of the issues right now is that we don't know who we are. Hmm. I mean, do Presbyterians know what a Presbyterian really is?
Yeah. That's a great question. You all tell me. No. I think it's a great question. I think we're living in a moment of great consternation and confusion. I'm sure about kind of the question of who we are. The we has changed a lot also since the 1950s. And so it makes sense to me that there would be confusion about who the we is and what it might mean to be us. I think that's probably
true. One more question?
Okay.
Pat.
I guess that raises in my mind, and there's probably tons of investigation going on in this respect, is looking at the theology that individual denominations embrace through history. You know, there's catechisms and confessions, and that's sort of the go-to place when people have questions.
Yeah.
And there's certain emphasis, there's certain highlighting on aspects of theology and biblical proof text that have become exaggerated and weaponized, which may be a turnoff to millennials.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of theological debates in mainline distant and recent past. And part of what I want to get to, and I know I got to stop, but part of what I want to get to, and this is one of the things that's really interesting and to me characteristic of the mainline and its history, this is a teaser for next week, here you go, is part of what has been true about the mainline throughout the past has been a really unwieldy big tent. And that's hard. So want to think about that next week. Unwieldy big tent with lots of different kinds of folks with all different kinds of views. And that's a tough thing to sustain. Okay.
Thank you,
thank
Heath.
You. Yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you, everyone, for being with us this morning. Next week, we'll be here again with Heath, who will help us take a look under that big tent that is the American Protestant Church. And we hope you'll join us.